The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At a tournament in Germany next month, one of the world's largest electronic sports organizations is giving players a shot at $250,000 in prize money, along with the possibility of a drug test. For the first time, the Electronic Sports League, or ESL, is partnering with the anti-doping authorities who test athletes in more traditional sports like cycling or soccer to crack down on brain-boosting drugs in an industry that attracts more than 113 million fans worldwide. Nick Wingfield is a reporter for the New York Times and recently co-wrote an article about it called Drug Testing is Coming to Esports. Nick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So which drugs are they going to be testing for?
Well, the main focus is going to be on amphetamines, of which Adderall is one. And but there are other drugs as well that will eventually be on the test. But initially, that's what they're going to be focusing on. Adderall being kind of an attention focusing drug that's prescribed for ADHD. And there's speculation that it might actually help competitive gamers, although we don't know that for sure.
Right. We know that college students are famously taking them for studying and testing. How are they going to be testing for this? Blood tests, urine tests?
It was a skin test initially that they're going to be doing, but they haven't been really specific about all of the details of the testing regimen. It will be random, though, so not everyone will be tested.
So why now? What is driving this decision to randomly test players now?
We're at a really interesting moment for competitive video gaming, which is called esports. It's gotten quite big. You have corporate sponsors that are coming into it, like Coca-Cola. You have media partnerships. ESPN has broadcast it. There are a lot of online broadcasting partners. And the leagues and companies that are involved in esports are becoming much more concerned about legitimacy. So they don't want there to be any perception that someone has an unfair advantage or is cheating in order to win a match, because there's a lot of money on the line in some of these competitions, and they want to make sure that this field continues to grow.
Yeah, I'm reading prize money alone expected to reach $71 million industry-wide. And of course, as you mentioned, all these sponsorships, sponsoring individual athletes and players?
That's right. There are different models all over the place. You know, in Korea, for example, there are telecommunications companies that have sponsored teams. In the United States, often there are privately owned teams that have players, but they do have sponsors as well. And the prize money has just gotten huge. I'm in Seattle, and this very week, there's a tournament for the game Dota 2 with the largest esports prize pool ever, $18 million.
Wow. Well, one of the players, Corey Friesen, he spoke specifically about taking Adderall to help him with his concentration. But what if players are legitimately diagnosed and prescribed Adderall or Ritalin for ADHD?
That's right. I mean, I don't know exactly what the policies are going to be, how much will be allowed. I believe that other sports have also kind of developed policies around legitimate uses of some of these drugs. You know, this is a fairly new policy that the ESL has put in place, so we're going to have to wait to see what some of the details are about, you know, legitimate uses of some of these drugs.
How are players reacting to the possibility of a random drug test?
I think for the most part, they're relatively positive about it. You know, it's really not clear how widespread the use of Adderall was. It's been whispered about, but it's not actually that clear also whether it gives you much of an advantage. The player that you mentioned earlier actually ended up not winning. His team ended up not winning, so it clearly didn't give him a leg up in that particular case. But I think overall players really want to see this whole area develop, and they don't want to see anything taint the field of esports.
Yeah, so in this attempt at legitimacy, what effect do you think it's going to have? Will people be more accepting or think differently about competitive electronic gaming?
You know, I don't think any perception that there has been doping in esports has harmed the growth of it yet. It's really been kind of underground up until this point. I think really esports faces other challenges to its growth, which is just making it more comprehensible and accessible to a wider audience. That's really what's going to affect the perception of it. And that's partly going to be a generational shift. You know, as kind of today's esports fans, people in their kind of 18 to 30 year old, you know, get older and their children come up playing video games and seeing esports as kind of a normal thing, I think we're going to see this field grow very significantly at that stage.
Nick Wingfield, thank you for speaking with us.
You bet.
Nick Wingfield is a reporter for the New York Times. You can find a link to read the article that he co-wrote, Drug Testing is Coming to Esports. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. It's taken decades and a massive shift in gaming demographics to make clear that video games are not just for kids. Recently, millions of adults have been buying another item that was once thought of as for children only, coloring books. It's all part of a larger trend of products and experiences, from footsie pajamas to summer camp, that cater to grown-ups who long to get back in touch with their childhood experiences. In Brooklyn, adults can even attend preschool, where they make crafts with glitter glue and have nap time. Call it regression or therapy, Adrian Rafel wrote about what is being called the Peter Pan market for the New Yorker magazine. And Adrian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are some of the best-selling adult coloring books now?
Well, one of them is by, well, two of them are by this Scottish artist named Joanna Basford, and her first book was called Secret Garden, an inky treasure hunt and coloring book. Inky treasure, I love that. And then her second one was Enchanted Forest, an inky quest, and she draws them by hand in her studio in Scotland, and they just completely took off.
They're beautiful books. I went and looked at her website, and when I started looking into them, I found that people that I know love these coloring books. I was a little shocked.
You know, it's funny. I was talking about this the other day to a friend of mine who's in the same PhD program as I am, and she said, oh, yeah, I used those coloring books when I was, you know, working on, stressed out about final papers. My friend gave me Joanna Basford's books, and I just, like, they worked.
Well, what do you think is behind their popularity, and how popular are they, by the way?
Well, so Joanna Basford's books aren't the only ones out there. There's a Creative Haven series by Dover. There's lots of these books in England and in France. But to give you an example, this spring, Joanna Basford's Secret Garden and Enchanted Forest were sold out on Amazon for weeks, and they were just like the two best-selling books, and you couldn't get them. I mean, you couldn't get them on Amazon for weeks.
So that's pretty significant. But well, why do you think people are gravitating towards coloring books for adults?
There's a sort of combination of things. I think there's this soothing effect of them, and they can both like sort of be as artistic as possible, but also there's zero pressure. And there's something about these books that is neither childlike, like you don't feel like you're sort of coloring in an outline of a character from a TV show or of like a little bunny or a bow or something, but also, you know, they're really sophisticated, intricate designs. They sort of put you into this is what proponents of them and people I've talked to who love them say, they put you into this kind of meditative, focused space that you just don't get in the rest of everyday life, especially sort of staring at screens all the time.
Mm. What are some of the other components of this Peter Pan market that you write about?
So one of the ones that I really loved looking into is Michelle Joni, this woman in Brooklyn who started an adult preschool camp where adults go and they like live by a superhero name while they're in preschool, and they have nap time, and they have glitter, and they have, you know, school pictures, and they have all the things that are like sort of form the components of your first memories, but you're doing them as you're 30 or 40 or whatever years old instead of when you're four. And, you know, it seems kind of ridiculous at first.
Do the people who are putting on this camp, I mean, is there any sense of irony about it? Or are they, I mean, what are they trying to do exactly?
So I think that it's a combination of this sort of like, of a sense of like irony, almost beyond irony, like no one could possibly take this seriously. So why not just go as completely ridiculous as possible and like go with the sort of, I think it's the idea that like if you sort of let loose and go with kind of this like crazily ridiculous idea in your spare time, you know, maybe that'll kind of loosen you up in the rest of your life so you can enjoy everything that you do and kind of have a little bit more spark in just kind of your daily proceedings.
It seems like there's a lot of nostalgia here, and I'm wondering, I'm just because I'm reading another book right now about hovering parents and, you know, the damage that the helicopter parent can do. Is this kind of idea that millennials or the generation of adults now wish to be protected? I'm not sure what's behind it.
So some of the people I did speak to, some experts I spoke to who were a little bit more maybe skeptical or incredulous of the progression of this trend, did worry that, you know, is this kind of a regression for millennials? Is this some sort of reaching back to a safer place, as you say, because of the both kind of the competitive pressures growing up and then the like pressures that you're facing, you know, like it sort of parallels a trend of 20-somethings moving back into their parents' houses mm-hmm. for pretty serious economic reasons. And then there's sort of maybe the darker flip side of all this kind of cheery glitter glue is this because we're having this kind of economically forced second childhood is one of the theories going around. And, you know, I wonder about that. I wonder, is that behind some of this really kind of almost aggressive like, reclaiming of the childhood that one perhaps never had?
But you also write that this is not the first time that recessions give rise to these kind of, I don't know, let's say recess-like activities.
Yeah. It's funny, in a recession, you know, in the 80s during the recession, the hula hoop, which was big in the 50s, all of a sudden came back into prominence. They were remarketing the hula hoop as like de-stress by, you know, getting back to your inner child. So as much as, you know, people are sort of worrying maybe or questioning the inner child coming out now, this has been a thing that has persisted for generations and generations back.
Do you think this trend of the adult coloring books and YA literature we can include in that, you know, summer camps for kids, preschool for kids, is it something that's going to stick around or will it just rotate like the hula hoop? I'm sorry.
You know, no, I like that. You know, I feel like the general structure of the trend is going to stick around. What's sort of on the table, be it hula hoops or coloring books or silly putty or, you know, toy archery things, you know, what people are using to express their inner child is definitely, I feel like, will probably end up rotating.
Well, Adrian, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adrian Raffel, she is contributing writer for The New Yorker, and that's where we found her article, Why Adults Are Buying Coloring Books for Themselves. And you'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. If you think about the roots of hip-hop, you may think of the evolution of African-American music. The blues, jazz, R&B, soul. One influence you may not have heard much about, Islam. Kelly Jones of Backstory with the American History Guys has the story.
Everybody over there!
Sing education! Everybody over here!
We all need respect!
This is Afrika Bambaataa, one of the founding DJs of hip-hop culture, with funk legend James Brown in 1984.
Peace, unity, love, and having fun!
Like lots of his peers, Bambaataa was raised on funk. He also grew up hearing household debates about Afrocentrism, black politics, and the Nation of Islam. Bambaataa would blend those sonic and political influences and create the Universal Zulu Nation, a movement designed to combat street violence by diverting gangs' time and energy into socially conscious hip-hop. The Universal Zulu Nation wasn't explicitly Muslim, but its desire to create a positive, Afrocentric culture was inspired by the Black Muslim organizations that Bambaataa had been hearing about at home.
So hip-hop is emerging, but at that very same time, in these very same communities, you have vibrant and active African-American Muslim communities. So hip-hop is born in that energy.
This is Suad Abdul Kabir, an anthropologist who studies the intersections of Islam and hip-hop. She says that these Islamic influences only grew stronger over the next few years, and points out that by 1988, Public Enemy was explicitly referencing Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan on tracks like Don't Believe the Hype.
The follower of Farrakhan, he'll tell me that you understand until you hear the man. They'll book up the new school rap game.
In the 90s, arguably hip-hop's golden age, references to Islam as a positive force in the Black community were everywhere.
From Wu-Tang Clan to Ice Cube to Arabi and Rakim, Lakim Shabazz, Poor Righteous Teachers, The Tribe Called Quest, Mos Def, Talib Kweli. I mean, and some of these people are Muslim, some of them aren't, but all of them have references to Islamic tradition in their music. All of them have references to this kind of Black Muslim ethic around community empowerment and self-determination and alleviating suffering.
Take Busta Rhymes, The Fugees, A Tribe Called Quest. They all came together in 1996 for Rumble in the Jungle. It's a song that combines ideas from the 5% Nation, a Nation of Islam offshoot steeped in numerology, with references to former Nation of Islam member Malcolm X, and references to Muhammad, the prophet and the boxer. Or take Sunni artist Yasin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def. His 1999 song, Umi Says, used the Arabic words for mother and father to encourage self-respect. Now, as the hip-hop generation has come of age, so have second and third generations of immigrant Muslims. One pretty easy way to fit in is to define yourself by what you're not. For Arab and South Asian immigrants to America, Suad says, that means defining yourself as not Black.
This, of course, for Muslim immigrants is a challenge, right? Because when you first come to the country, you find there are Muslims who are here. And the Muslims that are here are the very people that you've been implicitly taught you should stay away from, right? And it becomes a source of tension, right? In American Muslim communities, you have people who are sort of like, you know, no, like, hell no, right? We're not doing this hip-hop stuff. This is not Islam, right?
On the other hand, there are many American Muslims, most of them young, who aren't Black but who do embrace hip-hop culture. Hip-hop speaks to them because it references familiar beliefs about the world.
So Lauryn Hill, on her first solo album, The Miseducation, right, she has a song called That Thing, right? And she's like, saying you're a Muslim, a Christian, sleeping with the jinn. So jinn is an Arabic term, right, that's for, I don't know what we would call them in English, like little devils, I suppose. I'm not really sure what we would call them, right? But now if you're like 13 or 14 or 15, 16, 17, whatever, you're young, you're American Muslim, and this is playing on the radio, right? Because when Miseducation came out, like Lauryn Hill, this was on the radio. This was like top 40, right? Well, that really has a profound effect on who you see yourself to be, because if it's on the radio, it's cool. And so if someone is talking about what you know, or what your mother's talking about, you know, at home, and it's on the radio, then that's cool and you're cool too.
But Suad says it's not just about passive listening. She's noticed that a lot of young Muslims in Chicago, many of whom are not Black, are also energized by hip-hop culture to get actively involved.
So they weren't just sort of consuming the music passively, you know, sort of in their bedrooms, you know, writing down lyrics and buying new sneakers. They were also sort of like doing sort of marches or, you know, sort of trying to organize young people on the south side of Chicago, right, to sort of alleviate or to sort of deal with the realities of what Black life is, too.
And it's the relationship between Islam and hip-hop that gives Muslim communities in Chicago common ground. Common ground that extends beyond race or ethnicity.
It really challenges this idea that the only way you can really be sort of quote-unquote authentically Muslim is if you're sort of doing things the way people do elsewhere. So whatever they do someplace else, that's Islam. You should do it that way. And if you don't do it like that, it's not authentic. And what Islam and hip-hop, like their relationship, it really challenges that because it says, well, no, right? Because we're Muslim. We've been doing this for a while. We have the same kind of like moral priorities. We're interested in the same sorts of things. And we're doing it as Muslims. And we're doing it not based on practices elsewhere, but based on a tradition that's been established and developed here in the United States. Like, I don't think there's another site that does that like hip-hop does for Muslims in the United States.
And that story was produced by Kelly Jones for a backstory with the American History Guys.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to humor, we at Word of Mouth are a team divided. Some of us like to think that literary puns are a wordy cause, and science puns are elemental. If you groaned or maybe even cringed a little hearing that, you are not alone. As The Atlantic senior associate editor Julie Beck recently wrote, people love to hate puns. They urge punsters to delete their Twitter accounts. They run screaming from the office punster. To better understand why people so abhor puns, we invited Julie and Charlie Hopper to duke it out and have some pun. Charlie works for the Young and Larimore ad agency. He's a songwriter and writes dispatches for McSweeney's. The one that we are talking to him about today is The Pun Is Not Your Friend. We've asked the two of them to prepare a brief overview of their arguments for or against puns. Julie, would you like to start off with the charm or the value of puns?
Sure. So, you know, there's nothing wrong necessarily with, you know, people who don't like puns. We all have our own senses of humor. And, you know, whenever somebody tries to be funny, there's going to be some people who don't think that they're funny at all. But the thing about people who don't like puns is they really tend to want to make sure that you know it. You know, they'll groan and they'll roll their eyes. And like you said, if you're on Twitter, as soon as you tweet a pun, you're going to get a flurry of exasperated replies. You know, God forbid somebody remain silent and risk thinking that, you know, they enjoyed the pun. But the complaint that puns aren't funny is to some degree a misunderstanding of what puns are and what they can do. One humor researcher who I spoke to told me that puns a lot of the time are less about the ha-ha and more about the aha. Though I maintain that puns can be very funny sometimes. A lot of times it's more of an I see what you did there. They can be sort of a way to stretch the boundaries of language in ways that can be silly or that can actually be very powerful. For example, Chinese is a language that lends itself very well to puns. And in China, people have used puns to talk about things that have been blocked by the censors. Last year, actually, Chinese officials banned puns from radio and television. They said to keep, you know, the culture of their language intact. But a lot of people suspect that it was actually to sort of quash the criticism that puns allowed for. They can also be visual puns, you know, images with more than one meaning. An example people see a lot is the Google logo doodles, the doodles that they do for holidays and stuff, or like the FedEx logo, which has an arrow in it. And you can see it in high art as well. There's a sculpture someone referenced to me when I was writing the article, which is the Picasso's bullhorn sculpture. Mm-hmm. To sort of describe it, it's like a bicycle seat and bicycle handlebars, and they're arranged to look like the head of a bull. And so that's an example of a pun that people might not necessarily think of, but what it's doing is giving a new and unexpected meaning to something, which, whether they're silly or whether they're serious, is what puns do.
Okay, thank you, Julie Beck. Charlie Hopper, over to you.
Well, a lot of good points. First, though, I have to say I'm a dad, and as a dad, I am required now and then to say a pun. So I'm not advocating zero pun tolerance. It's like puns are Fritos, and it's okay to eat Fritos now and then. Just, you know, don't eat too many Fritos. There's three reasons then that it basically becomes anti-pun at that point. First, it's like a pun calls off the hunt. You see it all the time. Journalists, especially advertising writers, the temptation is huge to stop when you get to a pun. It always gets a reaction, and it seems relevant, like it ties two ideas together, but then it uses up space where you could have really made a human connection. Because the second thing, a pun is it's just playing with etymology. It's just a coincidence of language. And after, like, age six, it's not that interesting to demand someone's attention to point out coincidences, you know, especially if you do it a lot. And then third, a pun is like a person who wants everyone to listen to them play the Maple Leaf Rag on the piano. They're not looking for participation, not trying to share any feelings. It's just forcing you to wait it out. So when someone groans at a pun, I think it's because you called off the search for a better joke by pointing out a coincidence of language in a one-way remark, which really can't be built on except by someone else coming up with another pun, which becomes the conversational equivalent of the old video game Pong.
Okay, there was Charlie Hopper. You know, we don't really have to continue the pretense of the debate, but now that you've floated some of your ideas out there, I'd love to pick up on some of them. One, that this is, the pun is a dad joke. Now, all of us have rolled our eyes at our dad's pun jokes. It seems that they're not mom jokes. Is there a sort of, I'm bringing gender into it already, is there a gendered nature of puns or pun makers?
Yeah, I like dad jokes. I think there is a weird thing online, and this is totally getting away from like the idea of puns at all, of like dad humor and people being really into dads and making jokes about dads. And you know, I think moms are very funny, and I think there's room there to innovate and to give some love to the mom's humor.
Well, let's talk about it as a sort of form of comedy. I mean, neither of you are saying that they're particularly funny, you know, guffaw funny. But unlike other forms of comedy, there's no real message other than playfulness or maybe cleverness. Are puns about showing how clever you are?
I think they can be. I think it's a way for people who like language to sort of play around with language. The woman who hosts the Punderdome, who I talked to, you know, called it like comedy's annoying little brother, like kind of poking you in the ribs. But I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, whimsy and silliness for their own sake.
Anything on that from you, Charlie?
Absolutely agree that whimsy and silliness are key. And I will even, like you mentioned in your article, Bob's Burgers, the burger of the day, and trying, you know, really to catch that exterminator truck. Every episode starts with a bunch of rats that run into the restaurant at one point. The exterminator truck always pulls up, and it has a different pun on the side every single episode. You try really hard to read it, and you laugh at it. And you've got Jon Stewart, you know, who we're all talking about right now, and his Mesopotamia. I would consider both of those, you know, very modern humor, very held up as funny things that are current. But to me, it's the Fritos thing. It's like they made a really great salad and then put a couple of Fritos on it. And it's if Bob's Burgers and Jon Stewart were mostly about puns, we wouldn't watch them.
Well, those are visual puns as well. Is it better? Does a pun work better when it's written rather than delivered by somebody? Which always has a kind of, I don't know, cocked eyebrow. They're waiting for the response almost.
I like both. I think it works in that sort of selling way as a headline of a story, or you see them a lot in advertising because it's quick and it's funny and it's clever and it gets people's attention. It's a way to connect with people quickly when you have sort of an economy of words.
That's true.
You also mentioned, Julie, in your opening statement, you said that at least you are getting a reply. At least you are getting a response. Isn't that the point?
Yeah. You know, I think that you see it a lot on Twitter, like I was saying, and, you know, it's what's worse, if you make a joke and you receive silence, or you make a joke and someone groans. Like, at least it's sort of being appreciated, if in an annoyed way.
You did put a link to someone's account on Twitter who'd made a pun who was getting a lot of flack for it, but at least he got a, at least he got a reaction. Isn't that the point on Twitter? Somebody picked up on it.
My only thing is are you sure that you want that crap? Because it's just a short circuit reaction. And I agree with like headlines and stuff. They are often a good way to show a sense of whimsy very quickly. But it's the opportunity cost of what could have gone there that I always wonder.
So, Charlie, are you siding then with the Chinese government and you want to ban puns?
No, I think, to me, that's more like the lady who blinked Morse code help with her eyes when she was given her hostage statement. That's that sort of story to me, and that's fascinating, to use the puns to get around the censors. To me, the key is, why do people groan? And like you say, you know, the people who deliver them often deliver them leaning forward a little bit and with a elbow jabbing to, you know, an invisible person to their right, and waiting for you to be annoyed. And it's like, that's fine now and then, but it's a very slippery slope if you do it too much. It's a very treacherous path.
I think by groaning, you're like giving in, right? Because I think the groans and the mock outrage are now like part of the performative aspect of puns. If people didn't do that, then you wouldn't expect it. And so I think even on Twitter too, I think that's part of the fun. I don't think anyone's really that angry that someone tweeted a pun about a political candidate, but you know, it's fun to be like, oh, delete your account, or I'm throwing my phone into traffic now. That's half the fun. People get it pretending to be mad about it.
Right.
So, Charlie, you said there's no real human connection there. Throwing your phone into traffic as a response? Human connection?
That person, by not making a pun, has created now a feeling of a human feeling that I know I've felt before. And by pretending to be outraged, they have amused me in a way that's not making me groan.
You're LOLing, you're ROFLing.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm hashtag chuckling. But one of my favorite things to do is play those hashtag games on Twitter. And they're basically elaborate puns. It's the most elaborate pun you can make then gets you a retweet or a star or a follower. And I can't be like the Chinese government. I just have to say, what could you have done instead?
Well, Charlie Hopper, thank you for speaking with us and being willing to play along.
You're more than welcome.
Julie Beckin, thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Julie Beck, she's associate senior editor for The Atlantic, where she wrote about the love of hating puns. And Charlie is a principal at Larimore & Young. It's an advertising agency. He professed to hating puns in a McSweeney's article.
So if you can't raise a chuckle, and if they don't like your puns that were clever on the BBC in 1951, you're the king, absolute king of corny. So let the bad times roll. You're an absolute fun factory with no quality control. Singing dad jokes are bad jokes. It's sad, but it's true. If you love your dad's jokes, the joke is on you.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, our mock debate over puns firmly established that they are often the go-to weapon in the dad joke arsenal. To further drive home the point, we spoke with one of our favorite science experts, Joe Hansen. Joe is the host and writer behind PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart. And if you're a fan of his series or his Tumblr, you may also know that he is a serious pun aficionado. We asked Joe why dads tend to lean on the pun when it comes to making jokes and why he is so keen on them.
Maybe it's the toughest, coolest, most intelligent way that you can make a joke is a little turn of phrase. I mean, if Shakespeare did it, I guess it's good enough for me.
Still, a witty turn of phrase may not reduce you to fits of giggles, but a good joke or a comical situation might just get you to lean back and howl or snort or tear up or roll on the floor laughing. Because of moments like that, we associate humor as the source of laughter, but laughter may have less to do with the joke and be more about connecting with others. Joe Hansen recently tackled the signs of laughter on It's Okay to Be Smart. And Joe, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me back.
We have all heard people laugh. We've all experienced it ourselves. How do you describe the sound, though?
It's like a weird form of breathing. I think of it kind of like a bagpipe squeezing our breath out. You know, it's not like the ha 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 that we write out in comics at all. It's a really weird thing the more you think about it. Lots of human behaviors like that.
And it's not just humans who laugh.
No, we've seen, we got to be a little careful when we say we see laughter-type behaviors in animals, but I just saw it in my two dogs this morning. They're rolling around on the floor and making this sort of breathy sound as a kind of a signal to let each other know, hey, we're wrestling, we're playing, but I don't mean you any harm. So yeah, we see this laughter-type behavior and things like rats, other apes like chimps. It's pretty widespread.
When humans laugh, what is going on with them physically, mentally, emotionally?
Well, there's still a lot of mysteries when it comes to laughter. I mean, you imagine trying to write that funding. I'd like to study laughter. Give me a bunch of money to do that. But there are some people doing it. A lot of psychology involved here. And what's weird about laughter is not really what we're laughing. You know, we kind of think that we're laughing about jokes and humor and stand-up comedy and things like this. But it's about what we're not laughing about happens to be humor and jokes. It turns out that only about 1 out of 5 times that we laugh in social settings is in response to humor.
So why are we laughing otherwise? I mean, it's not like people are tickling us at cocktail parties.
Well, I hope not. That's a kind of a funny cocktail party. It turns out that we use laughter to communicate kind of social connections and to disarm the people that we're talking with. Say that you tell a joke to a friend of yours. You're actually much more likely to laugh being the one telling the joke than the person in response. That might also mean we're not that good at telling jokes, but we're also maybe 30 times more likely to laugh if there's other people around. It just seems to be this social bonding behavior among humans to kind of get some underlying signal out to for comfort with those around us.
You talk about this in your video, and I remember seeing some studies about this, that fake laughter actually does not fool the brain. Tell us about that research.
Well, it shows us that laughter is this ancient behavior among humans that we've been doing for so long that we somehow are really keyed in to be able to pick up on fake laughter versus real laughter. Now, children are a little bit worse at this, which is why, like, the big purple dinosaur, Barney, they can't seem to tell that he's faking it. But we are able to pick up on tiny cues, and we're just starting to realize what those are. It might be little differences in the way that the air comes out. It might be tiny facial expression differences. There's a famous way to figure out if somebody is smiling for real, and that's if they engage one particular muscle in their face. It's called a Duchenne smile. They engage the zygomatic major muscle, and then you just can't fake that kind of smile.
That is fascinating. Well, let's hear you in your video. One is a fake laugh, the other is a real laugh. So, Joe, which is the fake laugh, which is the real laugh? I'm going to guess A is the faker.
Well, I think you're correct. That's right. I mean, I'm a pretty good fake laugher. I mean, I've been practicing for a long time. I wanted to make this tough, but you are correct. A is a fake laugh.
I couldn't really put my finger on exactly what it is. Maybe that's the breath of air or the kind of, I don't know, there is something that is enforced about it. But it's so interesting that children can't tell that same thing because, I'm just riffing here, but evolutionarily, maybe that was a way that we connect with children. We could make them laugh easily by pretending to laugh.
You know, that's a great theory. And it speaks to this behavior of laughter being, like so many behaviors that we do, a little bit learned and a little bit innate. So, you know, there's something inside of us that gives us some clues, but we need a bit of practice throughout our life to kind of fine tune that sense of what's real and what's fake.
Well, have you heard of laughter yoga?
I haven't.
Well, there are these proponents of something called laughter yoga, and it may have started in India. I don't know. It sounds very California or something like that to me. But so they actually just sit and laugh, and I've watched videos of them, a bunch of people laughing together, and maybe it starts as fake but then becomes real. Is that the sort of, I don't know, social aspect at work, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, imagine when you're watching a movie. If you're at home watching a funny movie, you know, you might laugh a few times, but we've all experienced that we're in a theater. We just seem to be laughing out loud more when there's other people around. It's just yet another example of the social angle to this. And honestly, if I was watching those people do yoga and laughing, I would probably laugh at or with them. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, there's something very joyful about watching people laugh. And you mentioned this, and I remember this being in a Radiolab episode, an actual case of contagious laughter. This was in the early 1960s, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, in what is now Tanzania, there was a boarding school, a girls' boarding school in 1962. Three girls start laughing, and it spread throughout the school, and then it spread to the village and affected, you know, hundreds of people. I think something like 95 different girls, and over 200 people ended up having these laughing fits for months. And honestly, we still don't know exactly why that happened.
Any theories?
Well, there's the idea of mass hysteria. There's a phenomenon called mass psychogenic illnesses, where just like ideas, you know, these strange behaviors can kind of spread throughout a culture or a society. It just shows how tightly bonded we are, for better or for worse.
There are a number of old truisms, you know, of course, a merry heart doth good like medicine kind of thing. What does laughter really do for us physiologically? Is it good for us?
Well, it's unclear if the act of laughing might release these positive kind of feedback loops in us, give us some good hormones and good neurotransmitters. But we know that we get that from social bonding in general. So if laughter is a piece of that, you know, we're releasing all those happy chemicals in our brains and bodies. This is just one ingredient in a happy life.
Well, Joe, thank you. You're just a yuck a minute. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Joe Hansen, he's host and writer behind PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart. You'll find a link to watch the episode on laughter and all of the others at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Some of the funniest jokes do not have long setups or clever punchlines. They're just misunderstandings writ large. Nate DeMeo is host of The Memory Palace, and in this short piece, he shares a famous misunderstanding about one of America's founding fathers, Ben Franklin, and reveals why it sometimes takes a long time before we can find the humor in historical mishaps.
I think the coolest thing about Ben Franklin isn't that he invented bifocals, or flew the kite, or charted the jet stream, or loved the ladies, or invented the urine catheter, or invented a musical instrument that sounded like this. Or that he started the first volunteer fire crew, or that he's in the Chess Hall of Fame, or that he designed that kick-ass join or die poster with a snake cut up into parts representing each colony, or that he tried to change the alphabet so words could be spelled like they sounded. No. The coolest thing about Ben Franklin is that when he went to Europe during the Revolutionary War to get support from the French, he was so famous, and his electricity experiments were so groundbreaking, that there were people in Britain who were terrified of him. People who thought that if he could fly a kite and trap lightning in a jar, then he was probably actually in France sharing with the king's other mortal enemy some sort of secret weapon, some sort of electrical death ray. Because here was a guy who had harnessed the power of nature. St. Thomas Aquinas had written that lightning was God's wrath, that if you were struck by lightning, it was because you had ticked God off. And here was this chubby American guy who, A, could bottle lightning, and B, had invented the lightning rod, which is like a shield for God's wrath. It's like saying, God, I know I might have done some bad stuff and you might want to smite me, but sorry, I just put a metal pole on my roof and now your little lightning bolts can't get me, so suck it. But of course, Franklin hadn't invented a lightning bolt gun that he was just waiting to unleash in the Redcoats. And a lot of the Franklin fear was just the kind of superstition stuff for the 18th century equivalent of tabloids or Glenn Beck. But the British government didn't take any chances. In fact, after someone had put a faulty lightning rod on one of its government buildings, and that building was struck by lightning and burned down, they assumed the whole lightning rod thing was a hoax concocted by Franklin to get the British to put these rods up that would actually attract lightning and burn the city down. They were so nervous about it that during their war against Napoleon, 220 British ships were damaged by lightning because they refused to put lightning rods in the masts. Meanwhile, the French, who had listened to Franklin, are just cruising around not worrying about lightning. That's the coolest thing about Ben Franklin.
That was Nate DeMeo. He's host of the Memory Palace. And we thank you so much for laughing along with us today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can also check our Facebook page, where you can read about a number of artists who are collaborating with kids to create weird hybrid works of art. Some very cool stuff. Check it out on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And from there, pass it along and tell a friend. After all, weird things travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.